What fruit tree was once wildly famous not only for its fruit, but its wood? Now, if you guess the chocolate pear, well, you'd be in the know. And no, it's not a chocolate in terms of a milk or dark chocolate. This is a 100% palm. And on this here episode 304, we're going to be talking all about it. So welcome to Cider Chat. Hey, 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 my name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. Bravo! I am over the moon for the chocolate pear, and if you know me, well, that wouldn't surprise you because I talk about it often. And no, I'm not going to tell you the more common name that you may have heard many times on this here podcast. You're just going to have to wait. I'm just going to stick with chocolate pear because, one, I love chocolate. And even though it's not made out of any kind of chocolate as we commonly know, it has this kind of cozy feeling, which chocolate does to me too. So I'm going to leave it at that. And you just stay tuned because we'll be getting up to that featured conversation shortly with Ben Kunisch, who's based out in the Pacific Northwest. So hold on to your candy bar, because in the meanwhile, we have a wee bit of news from out and about in Ciderville. The American Cider Association invites you to their 12th annual CiderCon, a global cider conference for cider professionals. CiderCon is taking place February 1st through the 4th, 2022, in beautiful Richmond, Virginia, at the heart of a celebrated cider region. With tours, tastings, educational workshops, demos, and more, CiderCon's return to an in-person event is bound to be one of the most energetic CiderCons to date. The ACA is excited to share that they have added another tour to the roster of exciting events that will be taking place during the week of CiderCon. During the Richmond Cider Tour, you will enjoy getting to know the Richmond area and cider scene with this tour of 5 cideries. In addition, there are still openings in 3 tasting sessions. In the Top of the Mitten High Latitude Ciders from Northern Michigan tasting, attendees will take a guided sensory exploration of ciders from near or north of the 45th parallel. You'll explore the impact of the Great Lakes, the soil, orchard history, and more on these ciders from Northern Michigan. In 400 years of alcohol history, cider, history, cocktails, and more, join Tiffany Barrier, a renowned mixologist, co-author, speaker, and researcher, for a workshop that will be one part history and one part inspired cider cocktail creation. She will talk about important names, historical figures, legendary black bartenders, and she will also teach you how to make amazing cider cocktails. In a cider among the faults, participants will have to put their detective and detecting skills to the test on this lineup of 5 ciders. Discussion will include detection and rejection thresholds, their impact on how ciders and faults can be perceived differently, and ways to avoid or fix the faults found in the lineup. You can sign up for all these amazing offerings during registration. Already registered, but interested in attending these sessions? Find the links to register via Eventbrite next to their description on the CiderCon website. To learn more about the wide array of events and educational sessions being offered, and to register for CiderCon, head to the American Cider Association website today. CiderCon is an ACA member event produced with the generous support of members and sponsors. Learn how to become an ACA member or sponsor today by going to CiderAssociation.org. We have another bottle from Sean Blaze down in Maryland. He sent this up. If you recall, I actually opened the package on episode 300 of Cider Chat, and it's only recently I was able to open up the bottle and share it with friends. Now, I still have a little bit in this glass here, so I'm going to pour some for myself right now. And I'm going to roll out a little clip here of us trying this for the first time with 2 other friends drinking cider. So we have Al Sachs and April Woodard here, and we were sipping away on this cider. Just a beautiful clarity. Oh, the nose coming off of this is incredible. But just listen to some of my friends here on what their thoughts were.
Hey, let me tell you what this is, you guys. But cheers first. Ching, 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 ching.
Ching, ching.
Cheers, cheers.
That's a bottle of Petulant 14-month barrel aged cider in a rye whiskey.
Oh, my God. I love rye.
It should
rye.
Drink very dry with subtle bottles. Bubbles, I mean. Yep. Not seeing any bubbles.
There's a little bit when you poured it.
Did you say petillant?
But yeah, well, he's calling it petillant.
It's very still.
Yeah, I think.
Well, it's not entirely still.
Mm. Well, it's cold.
Other than
it looks still to me, too.
But. Other than a very, very few.
Super bright.
It's delicious. I certainly get the rye.
Yeah, it definitely is.
I drink a lot of rye whiskey.
Do you?
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, I'm a rye whiskey. I prefer rye to bourbon.
I love barrel aged cider. Period.
Yeah,
right, me too. I'm not
like, especially
some don't.
Like spirit barrels.
Oh my God.
I love it.
But this is.
I think it's nicely balanced. Now, I'm not quite sure that starting off with eating a brownie is the best way.
I think it actually went well with the brownie, to tell you the truth. I think the brownie really
enhanced it.
Was kind of perfect.
But I feel like I lost some of the subtle stuff.
I wouldn't call it petulant, really.
No, I don't know why. I mean, I've been holding on to it for maybe like 2 months I got it.
No. Yeah, but it shouldn't have been like that.
So the brownie was a chocolate brownie, and that's what we're talking about there. And as far as bubbles in the cider, I found it to be still. That happens, you know, happens to the best of us. But what really counts is this cider doesn't necessarily need bubbles because it's so smooth. And I want to say, Sean, you have totally 100% drawn me into that rye whiskey barrel. It's just so smooth. I mean, 14 months in a barrel, you might think, oh, it's going to be really overpowering. But it's just hitting it on the mark, and it's a dreamy drink. I can imagine pairing it with some really wonderful cheeses, some like a smoked Gouda, or some kind of barbecue sauce, a roasted chicken with barbecue. Oh, I'm getting hungry, and it's kind of making me really salivate too. So I'm going to take a little break here, but I just want to say kudos to you, Sean, and we're staying tuned. We want to hear when Blaze Cidery opens in Maryland. We are rooting for you 100%. As always, if you'd like to send your ciders my way, I might taste them alone because I do drink alone occasionally. Don't tell anybody. I shouldn't be trying cider while I'm doing the podcast, honest to goodness. But, you know, it goes with the territory. Or I might lasso in some friends who are always game for trying cider. And who knows, you might make it onto Cider Chat as we go through your cider. You could always send it my way if you'd like to. Just contact me. Send an email to info@ciderchat.com. Are you sending your ciders in to the New York International Cider Competition? I know it's not for, you know, amateur makers like myself. It's for commercial makers. And I know a lot of you out there are commercial makers. And this is, you know, the clock is ticking because the competition happens on February 21st. Coming right up. And so I thought it'd be kind of cool to like look at last year, which was the third annual competition. Remember that the New York International Cider Competition judges based on, are people going to buy it? Really, that's what it is. Are people going to buy it? And that kind of puts everything together. Like, you know, is it hitting the price point? Is it hitting the style? If I owned what we call in Massachusetts, a package store, would it get on my shelf? So let's look at this. You know, let's go over the winners and see, like, you know, how many people put in. Well, it says that in last year's competition, there were 300 submissions, which is pretty darn good, right? That's a lot of good ciders coming in from three different countries, and it had 10 plus different categories. And I'm seeing that there was a winner from Arkansas. I don't know about this cider, Black Apple Hard Cider, Iowa. I'm going to go to like these obscure places that I haven't really heard too much about, Iowa, and that is Fishback and Stevenson. Nebraska, there was Papa Moon Vineyard, and then James Arthur Vineyards. These are regions that we don't talk about too much. And here's a Texas cidery, High Cider Company. And let's say that I'm looking at some ciders. I'm going to go to competition sites to see what are people enjoying, what's getting the medals, what's working. And I would probably go to a site like this if I owned a Packy in Massachusetts. And I would say, oh, look at this. These three different cideries in Massachusetts did well. We had Ragged Hill, who I love, and then Stormalong. Both of those cideries have been on the podcast. And also the Muse Cider Bar, which is at Valley View Farm, one for the Massachusetts Wood Age Cider. I wonder if that was the cider that April Woodard made for the Muse Cider Bar. They're still pouring that. Could be, because she's a good cider maker. So this is how it works, right? You put your ciders in the competition, and it doesn't just end there with your little medal. That is put up on a website, and people are able to refer to that because they know that the judges are going by price point and styles and whether or not people are going to buy it. And to me, that is money well spent. You could check it out, register, get your ciders in now. And again, the time is very limited. And I know that, you know, look, it's a freaking pandemic. You're not going anywhere. You have the time to package your cider, make them all look really, really pretty, put them in the box, and ship them to New York. Find out all the details at nyicidercompetition.com. I'm going to give you this one more time. It's nyicidercompetition.com.
Walking through the orchard.
Darn, this bottle from the future Blaze Cidery is empty. I'm so sad. It's so good. You can tell I'm having fun, right? Well, you know, that's what cider's all about. Anyways, we're going to be going to our featured conversation now with Ben Kunisch, who I have been following for quite a while on Instagram. And he has a story to tell because he didn't quite know that this particular palm fruit was called the chocolate pear. A friend of his turned him on to it. And now, going on to the World Wide Web, you can find chocolate pear. There it is. But we didn't know. And now we do. And that's the cool thing about Ciderville. He's going to be sharing with us his story about foraging and how he took a trip overseas to the Czech Republic, went to a very cool museum, all focused on the chocolate pear. We're finding out about a festival and his passion and love for this. And to top it off, there is a book coming out all on the chocolate pear that has now been translated to English. So there's good news. And if you are a Pope out in France right now, and you know who I'm talking about, if you've been listening to Cider Chat, kudos to the Pope, because this is good news, and I'm sure he's doing the happy dance right now, which would be really cool to see Arnold doing the happy dance. He could rock it. So let's roll right now with Ben Kunisch. Grab a glass and join this chat.
We were planning this trip at the end of the year, open-ended, and we visited a friend of a friend who has an orchard, and he said, oh, if you're going to Europe, you should try to find out about this fruit called the chocolate pear. He said the Latin name Sorbus domestica, and it grows in Europe. We were in a hostel in Bulgaria planning the next part of the travels into the Czech Republic, and something popped back into my brain about the Wikipedia page for Sorbus domestica, which mentions a festival and a museum in South Moravia. Somebody else put me in contact with Vitek, who's the Czech, probably one of the most foremost experts on the species globally. The next day we went to the museum and arranged a meeting with Vitek, who luckily speaks English because I don't speak Czech. Toured his museum, talked to him about fruit trees, got to see his trees, And also then got to see some of the oldest Sorbus domestica trees possibly in the world. 400, 500 year old trees. They look like oaks. The trunk is, I mean, of these trees is at least maybe two and a half feet in diameter.
Wow.
I saw them blooming. This was in May of 2019.
And how healthy did it look at 400 years old?
It was beautiful. Crown branched probably 12 to 15 feet up.
Uh-huh.
You know, it would have been impossible to climb without a rope. And it was just beautiful. The bark, kind of silvery, looked like puzzle pieces, kind of. Uh-huh. Not quite like a pine, very much like an oak.
Uh-huh.
Maybe like an old pear tree.
Yeah, that makes sense. How about the soil? Was it in, you said scrubby forest, so kind of sandy, that kind of classic, not a really big fertile landscape. Is that true?
I would guess the soil there is fairly sandy, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
South Moravia is the wine-growing region of the Czech Republic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Petrov is known for the wine cellars, which is a whole other story. But I had some really wonderful and surprising wines in the Czech Republic, which I don't think of as a wine-producing country.
Sure. Beer is what everybody thinks, but they
yeah.
know how to ferment, right? So they got that going for them.
Yeah, we had some wonderful wines. And a lot of the vineyards still have Sorbus domestica trees planted at the edges of the lines of grapevines.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which is great to see. That was, I think, traditional across Europe.
Mm-hmm.
In the Mediterranean, and a lot of those trees have been cut down.
And why were they planting them in the vineyards? What was your take on that? Because, you know, you want the vines, you know, grapevines to get, like, you know, intense sun, no doubt, and the high heat for the fruit. So why are they planting sorbs out there?
I don't know.
Hmm.
But I know that they were planted at the ends of the rows of grapes, and in some cases they still are standing there.
Hmm.
So I think they don't shade the grapes too terribly much. And I think the fruit really was important as a additive.
Hmm.
So having them in and around the vineyard would have been a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that for certain. I'm sort of guessing.
I know. It's kind of a guesswork. It's like this mystery that I feel like we're all trying to solve a little bit. And when you say as an additive to the wine, of course, you know, having that conversation with Arnold, he was talking about how it would cure an ailing wine.
I think it took the place of sulfites, which mm-hmm. are widely added now,
mm-hmm.
and possibly other things, sorbitol or sorbic acid, are in the fruit. But yeah, I'm not aware of them being widely used for winemaking in Moravia. Again, I really don't know. One main reason that they're still very much appreciated in that region is for distillate.
Hmm.
They make distilled liquor, and here's a bottle for visual aid.
Oh, nice.
For podcast. But this is a brandy made from Sorbus domestica fruits in South Moravia.
Yes, well, it's clear that you would expect. It has a nice little etching, like with a white pen, you know, a glass pen of the actual little sorb fruits. Let's step back a little bit to the museum. What was that like?
I would say quaint, but it's better than quaint. It's a two-room building, and it features lots of photos of notable trees, as well as like small craft items that are made from the wood. They sell marmalade or jam made from the fruit, syrup. You can take a shot of Oskarushevice, which is the distilled brandy. I bought a lot of postcards.
Why not? That travels light.
Yeah, and they sell books about the tree, a lot of pictures of people and harvesting the fruit, making the brandy. The brandy really is of central importance culturally to that region. So, you know, for better or worse, I think that's the major reason that the tree is still recognized as so important to the culture there. The reason that I am so fascinated by the tree, I think, is because of its age. It has to be something that is planted for the next generation or inherited from the previous generation. Up until 100 years ago, sorbus trees were widely planted and very old trees were widely taken care of in Europe. And they began to be replaced by apple trees, pear trees, and higher production, higher profit fruit crops for cider, for perry. People growing fewer crops with more predictable but arguably less interesting characteristics. Really tremendous loss of biodiversity. And I think this is even true with apples. I work at a nursery that grows 40 varieties of apples, which seems like a lot to me, but there are thousands of, maybe tens of thousands of named varieties of apples. And a lot of them are rare or extinct or nearly extinct. And so I think there are a lot of plant species as well as varieties that are at risk of the same sort of treatment. And there's a lot that's lost when that happens. The name sorbus originates with service tree. It, you know, originally that was the sorb or sorbus tree, going back to Roman times. So when Linnaeus comes along, that's where the Latin name for the entire genus comes from. Now people go back and they've subdivided the sorbus genus into rowans, white beams, and service trees as three main classes, is my understanding. So genus sorbus, subgenus sorbus would contain the rowans, mountain ash. White beams would be sorbus aria. Some people would know that as the parent of Shipova, which is a sorbus pyrus cross, another nice fruit, sort of rare, but more widely planted than service trees. And then the service trees contain two species, true service tree and wild service tree. So there's sorbus domestica, sorbus terminalis, both really large trees. Sorbus domestica has a large fruit. Sorbus terminalis has a small pear-shaped fruit. It's a little bit more sour, still has a wonderful flavor and also medicinal properties.
You know, to actually create a museum, I mean, that's a big deal. So is this something that there's like a little festival? You mentioned something like that. And what time of year that takes place? And is it like a one-day event?
I believe there's one in the spring during the flowering period, which is very short, actually. It's 7 to 10 days that they're in bloom. And the main festival each year, and I'm not sure that they've done these for the last couple of years, but the main festival has been in the fall during the harvest. Yeah, these are organized by the community. I believe Vitek's involved. I'm not sure exactly whether he's personally hosting them or just involved. But he is the main force behind the museum, and he's the author of the book in the Czech language about Sorbus domestica, soon to also hopefully be printed in English.
Oh, great. That's wonderful. Wow. That's going to be a really good benefit for everybody. It's huge.
This is the manuscript of the English translation.
Wow. Right on, man. You have a copy. Jeez.
So I did the proofreading of the... I didn't do the translating, of course, but this is... this has been a project for the last year, is proofreading and editing the translation for clarity. And I will probably be contributing a small section as well on Sorbus domestica in North America. of which very little is known.
No, I'm loving this. Here you went on this like little journey, and it just like has blown up in this beautiful way. It's like the tree has been waiting for this, and one of the native sons to come back again in a way. You know, how cool is that? Damn, I love it.
I've been asking myself all week, why? Because I figured you would ask me, and I still don't have a good answer. It's just something I'm interested in.
Yeah.
You would think it's the only thing I'm interested in, but really it's just one of many things. just happens to be something I spend a lot of time thinking about and reading about and promoting to other people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, let's face it, it is a super interesting tree. I mean, it has so many different elements that, you know, the way it grows and all that. And of course, people could listen to those previous episodes. But I'm wondering, when do you find that it's going to fruit? When can people expect it to fruit? Is it like a 100-year tree to fruit? It's earlier than that, because the Sorbus domestica that I visit here in Massachusetts was, I believe, brought to the Arnold Arboretum in 1947, I think, something like that. I should check it. It's from the Czech Republic.
Yeah, which is interesting because I don't know any other trees in North America other than the little seedlings I've grown that are being grown from seeds from the Czech Republic.
Mm-hmm.
The trees I know of, the mature trees in the Northwest here, the ones for whom the ancestry is known are from present-day Croatia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How about the ones down in California?
Unknown.
Unknown.
I have my suspicions that... So Felix Gillet, French-born, famous nursery man from... What was his nursery? Baron Hills Nursery, I believe, was the name of it. He published a catalog in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and he lists Sorbus domestica from 1800. The latest catalog I've seen of his is from 1901, I believe. He listed it every year after 1800. So he was selling Sorbus domestica seedlings from Nevada City, California, around the West Coast. I'm not sure how widely his distribution was at that time. My suspicion is that Luther Burbank may have acquired his original seedlings from Gillet, which could have been French or German origin.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. I'm guessing they came from some selected tree or one that was already a good producer. And my understanding is that in terms of fruit size, at least, they grow relatively true to seed. If you plant a seed from a large fruited tree, they should produce a fairly large fruited tree. So at the Burbank Gardens, I haven't been there to see these trees, but I'm in touch with Spencer, who lives in Santa Rosa or Sebastopol. And he's measured the trees. He's gathered fruit from most, if not all of them.
Mm-hmm.
He said there's a large tree at Luther Burbank's former house, as well as two rows of trees that are very densely planted at the former Gold Ridge Farm experimental station, mm-hmm. where Luther Burbank did a lot of his planting trials and selection and breeding. And I'm not sure he got more than one generation in. I don't know if those were seedlings from a tree that he selected or whether they were just seedlings that he sourced from someplace. But he planted them really densely. Those trees are still standing. They still produce fruit. It's hard to say how old they were, but you know, they're probably 70 to 80 years old. I'm just guessing. Spencer might have a better guess.
And the fact that they were all planted, you know, close together, because everything I know about them is that they like to socially distance. They like their space. Did you hear that too? And is that what you've seen in the manuscript, is that they really want to have room? Because that's what I've been kind of dealing with, trying to find the perfect spot for the Sorbus domestica that I have on giving them the rightful spot so they could sit there for the next couple hundred years.
I think of them like chestnut trees, both in terms of size and longevity, and also the way that the fruit is harvested, being from the ground rather than from the tree. Mm-hmm. Most fruits, at least for fresh eating, are picked from the tree. But in the case of walnuts or chestnuts, they fall to the ground and then you harvest them. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely true of service trees. So I think they benefit from having a lot of space underneath them that is either grass or bare ground where it's easy to find the fruit. Mm-hmm. And the more room they're given, the more they can really spread out, build that beautiful crown, and then cast their fruit in a wide area. Mm-hmm. But that said, three trees I know of in Seattle are planted relatively close together, probably 10 to 12 foot centers. And they were planted in the same year, and they've grown up to be quite tall, and they seem perfectly comfortable growing in a grove like that. Something I know about chestnut trees as well is that if you plant chestnut trees very close together from a young age, they'll grow fine. But if you plant a young chestnut tree under an old chestnut tree, it'll be starved for light. So I suspect something similar happens with sorbus trees. Mm-hmm.
I just think, though, if you are going to be planting them and you're looking at, you know, like planting a pear tree, you know, for your heirs, that it would probably be really good idea to give them ample space, because then if you are going to be using the fruit or, you know, somewhere down the line, the wood, although I would be more focused on the fruit. You know, give them space so it's like they could really branch out and do that. The tree that I I visit, it's doing great, but it does feel like it's cramped in, you know, it's pretty cramped in. But it has a nice south direction, and that side is not blocked at all, which probably is the reason why it's doing so well.
Yeah, the tree in Portland that I know of is by far has the most space of any sorbus domestica tree that I know of here. It's growing on a large grassy hillside. There are some trees to its, I believe, north, but to its south and what I think is west, there's nothing. And so that tree spreads out. It has a huge branch that comes out right about breast height, which made measuring it for Arnold really a nightmare, but I did my best.
Cool.
It has this wonderful spreading canopy, and it really shows what the growth form can be like if you give it that space. Mm-hmm. The trees in Seattle, they have almost more of a timber form because they've been grown so close together. Mm-hmm. And that's part of how they'll get straight timber trees for, at least for things like walnut, black mm-hmm. walnut or chestnut, mm-hmm. is planting them close together and encouraging them to go straight up, compete mm-hmm. for light, but you get a nice straight trunk that can be, you know, later cut for boards. Mm-hmm. Or lumber. To answer your previous question about when they fruit from seeds, I believe it's anywhere from 10 to 12 years, possibly as few as 7 or 8. There's a lot of conflicting information out there. Some sources claim that it's a very slow-growing tree, and it may be in certain climates, places with cold winters or short growing seasons. Generally, I think of the Pacific Northwest as having a short growing season, at least in terms of chill hours. We have one of the shortest growing seasons in North America, or the lower 48 states anyway. But on the other hand, I was talking to Arnold about this, and the tree in Portland was planted in the late 1950s, making it only 70 years old. And the diameter of it is incredible.
Wow.
It's a really large tree, which would suggest actually a fairly fast-growing tree, given the right conditions. Mm-hmm. In terms of sunlight, water wouldn't be too much of a problem in the Portland area, though we do have dry summers. So I think it can, and also the first couple of years, it can be very slow-growing. The seedlings that I planted 2 years ago grew generally under a foot in their first year, compared with some trees that could grow 3 or 4 feet. Even apples from seed can grow a lot faster. But in the second year, they've put on 1 to 2 feet. So I think given the right conditions, they will grow pretty quickly in the first couple of years. Yeah. Without knowing from personal experience, I would guess 8 to 12 years from seed in terms of fruit production, but it could be as long as 15. I think where people get that 30-year time frame is for relatively full production from a seed to a reasonable crop of fruit could take 30 years. And that makes it not particularly commercially viable for most orchard models.
So what are you hoping that folks will do with Sorbus domestica?
I want people to appreciate it. That what I hope for people is to plant trees that will live longer than they will and to encourage others to take care of them beyond their individual lifetime and to also continue with, you know, the type of like land management practices and farming and food production and fermentation that will produce something that's beautiful, high quality, that will outlive them as a tradition. So this is something that you know, around fruit in particular, there are traditions, I think, probably on every continent, of really long-lived trees. And if you have a sorbus tree in your yard in Moravia, you're going to get up to a metric ton of sorbs every year. And there's a market locally for that.
Having picked sorbs, you know, they're pretty tiny. Like they're sometimes like they as big as an acorn, but the ones that I've seen, they look like a small pear, right? So there's like the chocolate pear. They're really cute, you know, and they have like a little orange or reddish blush to it when they're ripe and opening up. It's pretty, very creamy, like you mentioned. I was just like, my goodness, this is so delicious, super delicious. And then I was there at different times of the year, and then it's like really, really bitter, right? So that, you know, when they're first being plucked. But it seems that for just people looking at to get a sorb now and plant it, Sorbus domestica, and maybe in their orchards, they're not going to be able to do this like high yield, high production thing. I don't know, maybe they will, but it does seem like it's a tree that just like, I'm going to do whatever the heck I want, and you better deal with it and set me up, otherwise I'm out of here. Would you agree? Or do we not know enough info about that? Because, I mean, look what people have been able to do with apple trees.
Yeah, and they're very responsive to changes in the landscape, changes in the weather. They're very sensitive to tillage of farm fields around them. Mm-hmm. They have roots in that upper level, even though they're also a very deep-rooted plant and can find water even in southern Spain or northern Africa. They grow down into Morocco, you know, fairly dry places, and up in the mountains of Turkey. I think they grow into Iran as well, if I'm not mistaken. So very widely adapted, I mean, from Eastern Europe all the way to northern Africa. But I've read that if a thunderstorm occurs during the blooming period and lightning strikes near the tree, that can destroy the crop. Yeah, not that the lightning would strike the tree, but just that electrical charge in the atmosphere, you know, will take out, you know, an entire half of the tree. So, yeah, I mean, as an agricultural commodity, they are not necessarily the best suited. I think they could be bred to have larger fruit or different flavors. I think they could be grafted. I've heard in Italy they're grown on small, you know, basically coppiced into these small little trees that can be harvested by hand. Not something I've seen, but I think that's a method of farming them in Sicily. There's someone in I believe in France or maybe in the UK, somewhere on the line there, who is, you know, interested in breeding. I've communicated a little bit. He's trying to gather all of the largest fruited varieties into one place mm-hmm. and then perform selective breeding. But when you're growing out a seedling for a tree that may not produce fruit for 10 to 15 years, mm-hmm. That's the sort of project that could easily outlive somebody, mm-hmm. as I think it probably did for Luther Burbank.
Hmm. I think of any time in history right now for the Sorbus Domestica, at least here in the U.S., with the passionate makers and people who are rediscovering apples and pears at a rate that we haven't seen ever, this is a great time to get people turned on to Sorbus Domestica. How long can they live? 400 years? My goodness, that's gone past like pear trees.
It's the largest and longest living member of the rose family, which includes all the palm trees. Yeah, so 500 years, maybe up to 600. I'm not sure what the record is. A lot of the old trees, they've rotted out in the middle, but the cambium still survives.
Like an apple tree would be? That's
exactly.
Producing, no kidding.
Yeah.
Huh.
So they'll continue producing fruit, you know, maybe where the windstorm knocked out one of the branches, created exposed mm-hmm. wood, and it's still very dense, rot-resistant wood, but over time that can rot out and hollow.
Do they have any pests, like the share common pests, like the apple or pear trees do?
Yeah, I believe they're somewhat susceptible to fire blight and possibly some bacterial cankers.
Okay.
But overall, they are fairly disease-resistant compared with apples or pears.
Mm-hmm. And drought-resistant, too. I mean, people do dry farm apples, but that's what I think is pretty interesting considering climate change and this hotter and hotter climate that we're getting. It seems like it's a good move to plant Sorbus Domestica that way because it will survive in a struggling environment. And I keep on going back to the vineyard, like, why did they plant these trees here? And sometimes I think, well, maybe they just liked a little shade tree for themselves that would just give them just a little bit of a buffer in a big vineyard, but
yeah.
Wouldn't be compromising the vines at the same time. I don't know.
That makes perfect sense to me. Mm. I think that's quite likely. And also, you know, it may be that they were drawing up moisture in some way that was then available to the grapevines.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, I just read Suzanne Simard's book, Finding the Mother Tree, and she talks about how forests, specifically old growth forests, but even younger forests, the trees are connected by mycorrhizal fungi, symbiotic relationships, and they share water, they share nutrients. She believes they share information, you know, such as it is. And so I think, well, maybe, you know, trees like service trees that are putting their roots, you know, tens of meters possibly down into the soil could be bringing up all sorts of water.
Nutrients,
available. When the leaves fall, you know, an incredible amount of nitrogen and carbon returning to the soil and feeding the fungi and the you know, insect and all of that soil food web and all of that life. So I think probably their role in that traditional vineyard, you know, going back before, you know, well before chemical fertilizers or you know, a lot of forms of irrigation, there may have been a lot of benefits that are hard to quantify, but nevertheless improved the health of the vineyard as well as the health of the people that were working in them or living nearby.
Added value that you don't even realize is taking place. So I imagine, you know, just kind of talking about this, I hadn't thought about it before, but because they are such tall trees, that if you were an orchardist with, I'm going to say apple trees, not pears, because I guess pears too, because they can be small, that you could have a towering Sorbus Domestica there, getting the same elements that maybe it was doing for the vineyards, and not be at risk of losing any fruit for the apple trees. I don't know. I mean, apples want sun just like the grapes, so you could have this kind of copacetic relationship between the two that and still get the benefits of having a Sorbus domestica tree in your orchard of high density apple trees.
Yeah, I see a lot of possibility for the tree among people who are interested in cider, just because a lot of them are planting orchards now with an eye toward the future, especially mm-hmm. people who might be younger, but mm-hmm. or even middle-aged, that, who knows what the market for cider will look like in 10 or 15 years, mm-hmm. but presumably larger and more diverse and totally. More, totally. You know, more room for niche products mm-hmm. that have interesting flavors or an interesting story behind them. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, that's why I'm excited to talk to you, is with the hope of promoting this tree toward people that are already planting orchards, already fermenting fruit, mm-hmm. you know, whether people can find a place for them, in an orchard or in a vineyard. I think now is the time to start planting these trees and see where the world looks, see what the world looks like in 10 or 15 years. Mm-hmm. But I think that there will be, for trees that are planted now, I think there will be plenty to do with the fruit when the trees grow up.
Well, let's stay in touch. I can't wait to hear when that book gets produced, and I'll do a little bit more research on that museum and stuff, and let kind of direct people to that. And I just love the name Chocolate Pear. You have me at chocolate, it's like, wow.
My partner has admonished me, because when people ask me about Sorbus domestica, I'll go off on a long-winded explanation about how it's kind of like a medlar, and it's related to mountain ash, and it makes a little fruit that's very hard, but then it gets soft, and then you can eat it, and it tastes good. And she says, just tell people it's a chocolate pear, and they'll be interested.
Ben Kunz, or as you would say in Slovakia, Ka une esh. You can find him on Instagram at strom_askorus. I'll have the link in the show notes to that for this here episode 304. And you could also find out about the museum and the Askarusi Festival, and also just some links to this research. And we'll be staying tuned when that book gets released in English, I imagine, coming up in this here year, 2022. So do stay tuned for that. I'm not sure why I became head over heels for Sorbus domestica, but I think it has to do with its ability to defy all concepts of reality. One, that something in the rosacea family can live so long. Like, we know that pear trees live a really long time, 300, 350 years, maybe 400. But to have a tree that goes on to like 500 years and delivers, even in its older age, delivers like a metric ton of fruit, that's really outstanding. And not only fruit, but fruit that maybe could be used instead of sulfites. That's pretty cool. And can definitely be fermented or distilled. And then there is also the fact that the wood is just absolutely outstanding for its strength, and is credited with really creating the ability for the Industrial Revolution to come about, because it could be turned into cogwheels, and you don't want to have something that's splintering up and not being able to like hold its own over quite a bit of wear and tear. So just an outstanding tree, and it likes to hang in the orchard, kind of likes its own space, and still allow light to come in. And I think the coolest thing is also that it can be grown in very low nutrient soil like sand. And I have a lot of that here on my special spot of Ciderville. I guess I just like things that kind of defy our sense of reality, like having a giant fire in the middle of the winter, and when done in an orchard, we would call that a wassail. You know, you bring people outside and they're thinking, oh, I can't go outside. I can't do that. And yet, all of a sudden, the fire's roaring. You're having a good time. You're singing songs. There's merriment, drinking cider. And you realize what you thought you couldn't do, you can. I don't think that is unique to cider making, because I think that's really true to podcasting too. And so many things that I have done in my life is to believe in what was once impossible is only impossible until it is done, which is a quote that I credit to Nelson Mandela and something that I use to lead me forth onward and upward through life.
Emergency flares.
Check.
Toolbox.
Check.
Firewood.
Check, check.
Hey, Palms, what's going on? I'm hearing this list. I mean, I could see the toolbox. We always bring that when we're going on a trip, but emergency flares and firewood?
Indeed, Rhea. Just in case there is a storm between Washington, D.C. and somewhere in Virginia.
Oh, you mean like it happened on the highway a couple weeks ago when even like Senator Kane was stuck on the highway for like 15 hours? That was awful. But we're going to be okay because, you know, we're from New England. We know how to like pull over a little bit early, think ahead. We're planning out our map. We're going to be okay.
Are you sure?
Of course I am, Ed Lars. We're going to be fine.
Harry, do you have the list of contacts?
Indeed I do, Mr. Quince. Indeed I do. Just in case we need to call someone.
Well, obviously you have it covered, and we'll be posting along the way. So folks will know kind of an idea of where we are at any given time, but mainly for the fun that is known as cider. And Perry.
Right.
Okay, well, I'm ready to close this episode because we got to start packing in earnest, or at least I do, all the stuff that we need to bring down because we're going to be doing recordings and having fun along the way, which is what cider is all about.
Maybe, Medlars, we should put on the list satellite radio.
Okay.
Well, anyways, everybody out there in Ciderville, stay tuned because the Talking Palms and I are headed to CiderCon 2022. And we're going to be acting like a Sorbus Domestica tree.
Maintaining social distancing.
That's right. Air hugs work. We're kind of all big pros on that right now. And before we fully roll out of here, I just want to say thanks once again to all the amazing patrons of this here podcast who help keep us on the air each week and every week for the past 6 years, now in our seventh season. You too can become a patron by going to the Cider Chat Patreon page, spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N, or hit the donate button at ciderchat.com.
Extra antifreeze.
Check.
Extra bottles of apple brandy.
Check.
All right. Well, now you're talking my language. And with that, we leave you here. This is Rhea Windcaller and the Talking Palms.
Hello.
Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
We like cider. We like palms. Of orchards and having fun. There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is. There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet. We like cider, we like palms, we like orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason, there is a reason why we do it like this. Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Oh yes we do.
We like palms.
Oh yes we do.
We love orchards, having some fun. There is a reason. There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There's a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum. Ba-da-da-dum.
We like walking down the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet,
oh yeah.
We like cider,
ba-da-da-dum.
We like palms,
oh yes we do.
We like orchards, having some fun.
Yeehaw!